You're listening to Fixing Fundraising. Joining the self-proclaimed Agony Uncles of the charity sector is a wonderful guest and their biggest pet peeve. Here are your hosts, Tom Dufresne and Andy King.
Hello and welcome to Fixing Fundraising. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Andy King.
Hello.
Here he is.
Hello.
He hasn't got a key to my flat just yet.
Just yet, but soon.
Yeah, I'm working on it. And this week we're trying something a little extra special, a little different, because
we've got a panel show,
right? Making the podcast wasn't challenging enough. We thought let's have a panel show.
Several guests in one go.
Yeah, it's fine. It's going to be good.
So today we're joined by three incredible individuals who are just going to introduce themselves now.
Hello, everyone. My name is Anaíli Castellanos. I have been a proud fundraiser for 8 years. Starting in international development at British Red Cross at UNICEF, and most recently went into medical fundraising at Anthony Nolan, where I'm senior philanthropy manager.
Sweet, thanks.
Awesome.
Hi, everyone. My name's Bradley French. I work at Team Kenya as development manager currently. I previously worked for another international development organization called COCO. I sit on the board of trustees at another international development organization called Children of Rwanda. So I've done a lot of fundraising in the international development sector.
Nice.
And I'm Jodie Marsden. I'm currently senior trust fundraiser at DePaul UK, a youth homeless charity. Before that, I was in the dog and cat sector, the fantasy dog and cat sector.
Is that the sector? Not even the animal sector. Specifically,
dogs and cats. And previous to that, I also dabbled in a bit of arts fundraising for a small charity called Artswork. So I've been all over.
Awesome. Thanks. And we all know each other through an incredible program called the Tony Ellicher Foundation, which, if you haven't heard of, is a really great platform where more junior fundraisers can get matched with senior fundraisers, helping them with their personal development. But at the same time as getting a mentoring, you get stuck talking to people like me, and I drag you on a podcast. Thanks.
Quite literally.
Yeah. There was no kicking and screaming this time round, but maybe next. So today's episode is a bit of a follow-up to episode 4 with Chris Richardson Wright, where we spoke about the Institute of Fundraising and whether or not it's representational for all fundraisers. And we thought we'd gather some brilliant young fundraisers together to talk about whether or not they feel represented in the sector generally, and specifically at conferences, before giving an example of the exact merit that younger fundraisers can be adding to conversations. So my first question to the three of you is, do you feel represented by the community that you see at conferences and anywhere else that you see the community?
Should I go first?
Go for it.
So I think I've seen myself represented at conferences more recently, but I think that's as a result of being a part of the Tony Ellicher Foundation program. So kind of getting to know some younger fundraisers and actually having the program build up confidence so that people feel confident speaking at such events. But until then, I'd seen very few people kind of similar to me speaking at conferences. Speakers at conferences tended to be further on in their careers, in very senior roles, generally working for large organizations. And as a young fundraiser working for a small organization, a lot of what they said didn't really kind of apply to the challenges I faced on a day-to-day basis.
Similar. I remember in my first fundraising job at Artswork, which was a really small youth arts charity, I had the opportunity to go, I think, to the first Trusts conference, but came back feeling a lot of it wasn't for me. It wasn't really aimed towards the size of my charity. A lot of very senior speakers talking about things that I hadn't experienced yet in my career. So I felt a little bit disconnected. But as you say, I think the longer you work in fundraising, it gets better. And the more confident you feel to go along to these kind of conferences and get a bit more involved. But I think it does come down to kind of you really having to push yourself to do that.
Yeah, I really I agree with that thing about pushing yourself to do that. My experience has been a little bit different because my first role was at the British Red Cross, where actually I was organizing the fundraising conference for the British Red Cross members of staff. So very early on in my career, I did have access or awareness of the main, you know, fundraising gurus that tend to
Sorry,
do a lot of training.
Can I just check? So
yes.
Was that an internal fundraising conference?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So my role was to organize actually two conferences.
Nice.
Yeah,
okay.
It was amazing. Exactly. I mean, that's why I fell in love with fundraising, because I had access to all the different income streams and, you know, so got to see like the bigger picture very early on.
Mm.
And I was organizing, yeah, the internal fundraising conference for the British Red Cross members of staff, but also an international Skillshare conference that was meant to build capacity in fundraising across the Red Cross and Red Crescent movement. So we had delegates from all over the world coming to learn from UK's expertise. And as part of that, I also had the opportunity to actually go and join a IOF conference, I think, on my first year of working at the British Red Cross. So I was thrown into this like very, very, very early on. But in terms of actually starting to have a voice or feel that I could, you know, bring something into a sector, it didn't happen until years later when I was having a one-to-one with my manager, and she was like, "Are you a member of the IOF?" And I was like, "Actually, no, I'm not." And she was like, "Well, why not? You know, it's important for us as fundraisers to contribute to our sector and to, you know, be active in it." And it was only because my manager basically nudged me into it that I was like, "Yeah, I should get a membership and I should try to, you know, keep abreast what's happening and try to participate more fully." And since then, I have been trying to, you know, I go to the first Thursdays. I sort of try to keep, you know, updated in the developments. You know, I have voted on the trustee elections that happened last year and this year. But it has definitely, I guess, it hasn't been right from the beginning. It did take some time for me to come around to that. I'm still nudging from my manager.
Yeah, so that makes sense.
Yeah. I also think to an extent, young fundraisers are probably costed out. I've never considered joining the IOF because it costs quite a lot of money. Every first Thursday costs money to attend.
Yeah.
So,
definitely.
For me, it's a difficult decision between, you know, do I see my friends and go out for dinner or do I go to Iowa first Thursday? I can only afford to do one.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a cost implication, and that's also possibly why what Bradley was saying earlier, that bigger charities seem to be represented more, because those tickets are expensive.
Yeah.
And Jodie, I know that you have said before that when you worked at Battersea, there was a fair bit of budget.
Yeah, because we had an organisational membership, so it meant, and also just quite a big professional development budget, as we were such a big charity. So we shared kind of passes between us so that people could go for 1 day or 2 days or a half day, and there was always an opportunity to do that, which was amazing. But it was a very luxury position to be in.
Whereas I assume Bradley's probably in the same position that I used to be in at East African Playgrounds, where like they wanted to be able to spend money on staff development, but they just like there just wasn't really the money there for it unless there was an extremely good case for it. So a lot of the conferences I got to go to, I managed to get there for free somehow, like volunteering at my IOF convention, which is a great way in. You get to meet loads of people, but it was kind of the only priceable way of doing it.
Absolutely. I have found myself in a similar position throughout my career and kind of not making any complaints at the organisations I've worked for, because they've always tried hard to give me career development opportunities. But a lot of the opportunities cost a lot of money, and for a small organisation, it's quite a significant sacrifice to put that money towards a conference where there's kind of no clear short-term benefit to it. I have found in the past couple of years, similar to Andy, I've found myself volunteering at conferences and doing what I can to get professional development opportunities for free. A lot of those have come through the Tony Alicia Foundation as well. So that's been another huge perk of being a part of the foundation.
And a lot of conferences and opportunities too have now started having kind of deals for smaller charities and bursaries. So it is getting a lot better, I think, noticeably.
Because the Fundraising Everywhere conference is coming up.
Yeah, in November,
And tickets are free for charities under a certain size, right?
Yeah, there's some certain like threshold, but yeah, for really small charities, it's 100% free, which is great. I think that's super accessible, and there's no reason why larger organisations shouldn't be expected to pay more, either through organisational membership or through some kind of sliding scale. The more people they send, obviously, the more they could save, in theory.
Yeah.
But there's definitely a responsibility for larger organisations to start offsetting some of that cost.
That makes sense. One of the things that I found interesting about your answers is that all of you mentioned that you did go to conferences quite early on. One of the questions I have was, like, because representation happens in many ways, and it's not just who's speaking at the conference, but who's listening. If all of you were there, that implies that junior fundraisers are there. But did you feel that there were other junior fundraisers in the room? And is that something that has to be facilitated at the conference and it wasn't, and that's why you didn't see anyone else there? Or did you think they were there and you just weren't part of it? I don't know.
I felt that I was there and there were some other junior fundraisers there. But not kind of as many as I would have liked to have been there. I think I was quite fortunate. Kind of one of the perks of working for a small organisation is that when opportunities do arise to attend conferences, there's less competition. So there hasn't kind of been a situation where we've had to, you know, share passes so that someone goes in the morning and someone else goes in the afternoon, as was just mentioned. If you've only got a couple of members of staff, then generally it's quite easy to share out the kind of career development opportunities that come around in a quite a reasonable manner. So yeah, I definitely benefited from being able to attend conferences quite early on. And like my experience was that I was finding people there in that were kind of a similar age to me, but they tended to come from small organisations, whereas when I start to speak to people from larger organisations, they tended to be from more senior roles. I guess there's more people in large organisations, so the places don't filter down as far in the organisation, so more junior staff can't access them, but I haven't worked in a large organisation, so I can't really say for definite.
Well, the Bridge Across, definitely, it was an opportunity for more junior members of staff, because it was the other argument. It was deemed that more senior members of staff wouldn't be able to take as much out of the conference because they were more experienced. And it was definitely seen as an opportunity to develop the skills of people that were, you know, early into their roles or their careers. So I guess I've had the opposite experience.
And what about, like, not just the, not moving away from, like, IOF convention, like, specifically, what about other opportunities in terms of, like, again, I'm not targeting the IOF, but IOF committees and, like, subcommittees and stuff, does anyone ever feel like they could or should be on those? And do you ever feel like they're a bit, like, not clandestine, but a bit, like, inaccessible to you? What's your kind of thoughts on that?
I mean, my experience with the different groups that I'm part of is it is just kind of an email chain, and I have no idea who the committee members are, to be honest. So even if I did want to be on it, I don't think I really would know how to. I think I once emailed the major donor committee or chair or someone, and they were really helpful, and they did actually say, you know, we'll be recruiting at this time, here's like how it all works, but then I had a confidence crisis and I didn't go for it.
Okay. Interesting.
What about you guys, Annalie Bradley?
So I'm on the IOF Northeast Committee. I think it'll be made official at the conference in the week after next.
Oh, you heard it here first.
Exclusive.
Yes, I have been attending committee meetings for the past 2 or 3 months. And it has been kind of a really great group to be a part of, and I've already gained a lot from being a part of the committee. I guess it was a little bit daunting kind of taking the plunge initially, and I probably kind of only went for it because I knew Emily Casson, who's the president. So kind of chatted to Emily about it, and she kind of reassured me that I could be of value and invited me along to a committee meeting to kind of see if it worked out. So I can totally see how people would have like a crisis of confidence, because you can often feel kind of imposter syndrome in fundraising and feel that you're kind of not worthy of being on a committee or being worthy of being given a platform. So having that reassurance from Emily, and then again having the reassurance from the committee when I did attend the meeting, kind of gave me the confidence that I would actually bring something to the table.
Yeah, and it wasn't audio, so you probably missed it, but when you mentioned Emily Casson, Tom did a little fist bump. So he's a big fan. And I think Emily is a great example of a person who spends a lot of time encouraging development in younger fundraisers and encouraging them to believe in themselves. Mm. She's a good spotter of talent. But I think the confidence thing is something that's come up quite a bit, both in this conversation and outside it. And I just wonder if there's anything that can be done to give people that confidence, or why that confidence is missing.
Not sure, really.
I wonder if... Go on.
I was just going to say, in terms of... Because we talked before about conference attendance. Very much when it comes to speakers, you do tend to see the same people over and over again that kind of become the regulars. And it does sometimes make it seem an impossible task whether you will ever kind of be that person that puts their name forward and gets the slot.
Emily, were you gonna?
Yeah, what were you gonna say?
Well, I just wonder if it's actually quite a natural thing. You know, whenever you start a job, you don't really know what you're doing, you know, during the first 3 to 6 months. Same with, you know, starting a career in fundraising. But I do think that the sector has certain leadership figures that provide inspiration and that, you know, junior fundraisers can look up towards. For me, certainly, it was Marca Sarita, who used to be director of fundraising at British Red Cross, was a very influential leader that I would look up to. And currently, Antoine Nolan, our Director of Engagement, is Aaron Slovel. And again, seeing his passion for fundraising and, you know, this sort of force to make the world a better place, it's really gets me up out of bed and go to work every day. So I wonder if this confidence, you know, sort of can be reinforced by the support from managers and leaders in the sector that will invite and you know, applications or conversations for junior members of staff to feed back into what we want the future of fundraising to be.
Yeah, definitely. And I think coming back to Emily Casson and the Northeast Conference that's coming up, I know that she... rather than, like, she did have applications to speak at the conference, but as well as that, she actively spoke to people that she knew wouldn't necessarily put themselves forward. And I am fortunate that I have spoken at a couple of conferences now, but I wouldn't ever have done that if I wasn't asked to the first time. I spoke at an FSI conference, but my manager asked me to speak at it. And because that went well, I had the confidence to go forward. And similarly with you, Emily, I guess when your manager spoke to you and said, why aren't you contributing? You can be. you were almost invited to. So rather than having to put yourself out there and potentially face rejection, maybe that's something that people that are organizing conferences should be considering when they do so, is that obviously the people with the experience are really important and you want to hear from them. But if you're going to develop the future fundraisers and the future of those people, you need to be giving a platform to that.
Yeah, totally.
I certainly, you know, one of the things that I love about the sector is how collaborative it is and how, you know, everybody that you will speak to will be open to chat through common challenges or to give you advice. And one thing that we haven't touched on, you know, that is that there are a lot of forums as well outside of the IOF. We know, you know, obviously the IOF is the thing that we all look up to because it has the name on the institute, right? but definitely, you know, there's Facebook groups like Fundraising Chat or more specialized groups that are also platforms for fundraisers to seek advice and to sort of start to grow that confidence or that network. I definitely have found out that, you know, talking to people after, I guess, at conferences or after events or whatever, like if you ask them to meet for a coffee, 9 out of 10, or actually I have never had someone that said no to meet for coffee.
Chat.
Must be a very charming
person.
That's
really lovely about our sector.
I'm kidding. It's mostly just politics.
And yeah, I mean, I've volunteered my time with the FSI before, and I put myself forward for that. I think it is probably just the grandeur and the size of an IOF conference.
Yeah.
Or just a conference in general, as quite an introverted person, that's more daunting. But one-on-one, giving one-on-one, you know, support and advice, I've done many times before, and I would always put myself forward for that. It's just something that is way more comfortable about it.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe that could be a way of, you know, baby steps to grow your confidence and work yourself towards that big IOF headline, you know, as a speaker.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting point as well, as the difference between introversion and extroverted. Because I think there's definitely an assumption that you see a type of person that is leading the charge of fundraising, and that not only all speakers are extroverted, but all fundraisers are and should be extroverted. And I know that Nikki Bell and Simon Scriver do a lot of work on that. They're the only fundraisers I know of that, like, self-identify loudly as introverted. And I wouldn't assume that they were because of the way that they present themselves, but also I think it's really good that they do talk about it. And as quite a naturally extroverted person, I've never had to look for that role model. But I don't know, Jody, you said that you're quite introverted. Do you have any other, like, role models that you look up to?
Liz Tate, I've not heard it from her mouth directly, but she it's always that everyone always said that she's, you know, a quiet leader and she does it amazingly, and everyone knows how fantastic Liz Tate is, and it was a joy to work under her at Battersea, definitely, and she was very much someone that I looked up to. But, you know, you can have as many inspirational leaders as you want, you still are an introvert.
But I do think, again, that, like, the invitation is always what would help that, and the chance to prepare it, and the chance to know that it's going to...
Helps to bridge that gap, make it a little less daunting if it's
a
hand up rather than a, you know.
Well, let's just start a scheme where you pair us off together. An introvert and an extrovert.
What was the introvert adoption scheme?
It's quite a good joke, but it could also be the future of fundraising. I like it.
I mean, that's how this podcast started, Tom.
Which one's which? I can never tell.
I adopted you.
That's true. I was adopted.
You tried to get rid of me the whole time. Not going anywhere. So, speaking of including young people in conversations and inviting them to speak, one of my biggest bugbears around this topic is the retention crisis, which is something that I think a lot of fundraising leaders are focused on, as to why people either aren't joining or are leaving the profession. And I think that Jody and I went to university together. We have a number of mutual friends who started their career as fundraisers. And less than 4 years after we've graduated, a lot of them aren't fundraisers anymore. And it's always a conversation that people are having at a senior level, whereas it's junior people that are leaving. And I think it's worth asking some slightly more junior people, or recently junior people, because I know a lot of us have either senior or manager in our title now, why they think that is?
Oh.
Immediate silence.
A deafening silence.
This is why they're not ours. No.
I don't even remember what article it was. I was skim reading it, but I read an article the other day that basically was trying to say, but it's not just money, it's all these reasons. And I just wanted to reply and say, actually, money is a huge thing. If I leave the sector, it's probably because I need more money to live and buy a house.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the bigger charities is much better, luckily. So that's how I probably ended up going to bigger charities. I think it is a lot simpler than some of these people are trying to make it out to be.
Yeah.
Or maybe I'm having a simplistic view. I don't know. Feel free to disagree with me.
I think that's a major factor. Amount of times you read a job description and it references having years of experience, it gives a kind of a budget that you need to bring into the organization. It kind of references having a degree, and then the pay just doesn't match up with kind of the objectives of the job. And in a lot of fundraising roles, you have to give up evenings, you have to give up weekends. Like, there are a lot of commitments to fundraising roles, and pay is a trade-off. I think you know that working in the third sector, you're not going to be paid kind of similarly to in the private sector.
Yeah.
But there is a trade-off. You still have to shop in the same supermarkets, and you still have to, pay all the same living expenses.
Mm.
Absolutely.
And, whilst most people working in the third sector aren't doing it to be able to afford, luxury cruises and things like that, you are doing it to afford a reasonable standard of living.
Yeah.
And some jobs don't even offer that.
Yeah, I think that the other side of that same coin is career progression opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because it's totally okay if you have an entry-level position, you would expect to make, less than a person with 4 years more experience than you. But then you do 1, 2, 3 years, in that position, and you find out that there's nowhere else to move to.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that's where people just jump ship. And I do think that is a problem, in a profession where it's all about building relationships that are long term with potential supporters and donors, so the funding for the organization is sustainable. That the person that is building those relationships tends to leave after 18 months. So it definitely creates a problem for charities that have to scramble, and every time a key valued member of staff leaves, to keep continuity in those relationships. And it has been really, really, telling coming to work for Anthony Nolan, where a lot of our researchers have been in the organization for 15 years, and they're incredibly skeptical whenever I come to, whenever I come to speak to them, in terms of, develop a proposal together, or let's raise funds for this project. And they will be like, what do you know? You're going to leave in 18 months, and I'm not even going to find out until someone new comes along, which is also a really big problem.
Yeah.
Because, a key part of being a fundraiser is to build relationships, yes, externally with supporters, but also internally with project members of staff.
Yeah.
So you can accurately demonstrate the impact of every donation and speak to funders confidently. So it is definitely a crisis for the system. And I do wonder how much of it is due to the obsession that we have with demonstrating how many peas for every pound go into the... No, it's not peas, sorry, pence. How many pence for every pound go into the actual cost? Quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
When I will say that every single pound that is donated to charities goes to the cause, because it's not only about delivering meals for starving children. You need somebody to deliver that. You need somebody to plan the logistics. You need somebody to do the budgets to make sure that you are getting value for money. You need somebody to, take the lead and do contracts with providers and, health and safety standards. you know, so to make sure that you're having the impact that is intended. So, well, a lot of charities do cut costs and do cut corners, you know, pursuing this obsession to deliver, you know, so 90 pence of every pound that you donate go into the, you know, so they can able, they're able to say that for every, okay, I need to say that again. I'm so sorry.
You're no, right. It makes sense.
Right. It does make sense.
It does make sense.
You're absolutely right.
Okay. Thank you.
Right. No, so, yeah, it's the nail on the head in terms of the almost cultural issue with the charity sector is that it became yeah. not even that long ago a race to the bottom of who could deliver projects the cheapest and who could demonstrate that in a really obnoxious, ridiculous way, which is this pence in pound nonsense that actually shows nothing about longevity. It's all about quick wins, which is totally bonkers for a sector that's based on outcomes. It's entirely based on outcomes. Yeah. And instead of demonstrating long-term outcomes, it's like, look how much we can squeeze out of a pound, which is bonkers. And you're totally right about that. And I think that puts off young people. Speaking as someone who worked as a fundraiser and then moved into the private sector, that puts young people off because I genuinely believe, and this is a hunch more than anything that's backed up, is that young people are way more, they're focused way more on long-term stuff these days, way more kind of long-term outcomes. They want to do something longer because they care about bigger things, right? Our generation cares way more about the climate and when the Amazon's on fire and all those kind of like really long-term things.
Yeah.
And the charity sector often just flips that on its head and it's really short-termist, which is... It's unsustainable. You're going to lose key people from investing in a career. Like you said, Bradley, you give up way more than just low pay. You give up way more.
Yeah.
You give up time and you give up relationships and you give up a lot of stuff to get that career off the ground. Mm. I could rant about that for ages. Can you tell? I was getting ranted. it's a real endemic problem, I think.
And back to a point that was made earlier as well in terms of actually getting people in the first place. And I've seen a lot of this, again, it's very topical in terms of most entry-level jobs in the fundraising sector needing a degree.
Mm.
And, you know, I do have a degree and I even went on what is basically the equivalent of a graduate training program in fundraising called the Arts Fundraising Fellowship. And I still, when I was trying to move into London, applying for very entry-level or officer-level roles in charities, was getting many, many rejections on the basis of not having enough experience. And here was me having done unpaid internships, a lot of Warwick Rag, had a degree in English, and also spent a year on a grad training program training me how to do fundraising. And I was being told for entry-level roles that I wasn't experienced enough.
Yeah.
And that's a story I've heard quite a lot. I have a very good friend who's really struggling to break into the sector right now.
Yeah.
And the colleague that sits next to me at work said that she really struggled to change careers. One of the things that I don't get about the charity sector is we talk about how desperately we need fundraisers, but also it seems so hard to get a job.
Mm.
I don't...
Schrodinger's fundraiser.
Yeah.
It's
we
very
have,
unusual.
We both have not enough and also way too many to give you a job right now.
Yeah.
But once we get you, you're going to have to stay for at least 8 years because we keep losing them.
We need
so.
Those. Yeah. Yeah, totally. It's not an anecdotal problem. Like, that's an anecdotal problem for sure. Like, and that's the kind of thing that isn't sustainable. And if it's always C-level execs or senior managers and above trying to diagnose that problem and solve it, they're not going to. But they're just going to keep hitting the same roadblocks. Pay is a big chunk of that equation. But then there are other things that feed into that that make it, you know, something that when people go, this isn't sustainable and I'm going to stop doing it.
I think there's a stage at which it becomes unsustainable for a lot of people. But then you also have to look at people from kind of different backgrounds that aren't able to get into the sector because, for example, I could volunteer when I was younger.
Ooh.
I'm from a middle-class background. Like, I could forego paid work for a couple of days a week to volunteer in a charity.
Yeah.
Other people don't have that opportunity. and they're being held back as a result of
massively.
That. So I think whilst for us it's about kind of having a bit more money to be comfortable and, you know, the sacrifice of giving up evenings and weekends and potential like family life balance and things like that. For other people, it's much more of a kind of entry barrier in that they just can't kind of get into the sector because they can't access this experience because they need to have an income to live whilst they kind of build their experience in the sector.
Yeah.
Or they need to have flexible hours because they've got a young family. And I think there is an improvement in this in terms of kind of organisations are becoming a little bit more understanding, but I think we're still quite a long way from it being kind of an accessible and open sector.
Yeah, 100%.
So for friends of ours that have chosen not to go into the sector, and I have quite a few friends who considered it and chose not to, I think universally the answer is pay. Or they tried and couldn't get into it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because they couldn't afford to do unpaid internships and volunteering.
Yeah.
So is the answer to that to have more lower entry-level roles? But then the pay problem isn't solved either, right?
I
think career progression would be a huge benefit because I think as long as in the short term you're earning enough to, you know, live, if you've got the offer of progressing in the career and that's an attainable target, then I think you're motivated to kind of enter the sector and remain in the sector.
That's true. Because I know a lot of people who, like, within 2 years of starting their career have almost doubled their salary, but they've had to go through that 2 years of proving themselves first. But they've been willing to because they know it's going to happen.
But I think this is where it links back to, you know, having your voice heard during the, instead of fundraising as well, because you can't really, you know, the sector is continuously attacked by the media, some media, in terms of, oh, chief executives are earning six-figure pound salaries.
Yeah.
So, you know, when charities are under attack on that basis, you can't necessarily ask them to provide paid internships or to raise salaries.
Yeah.
You know, I going back to this sort of obsession with the pens that go into the cause.
Yeah.
So there's definitely something about pushing upwards towards the leaders in the sector to speak more about this as a problem, as a something that is hindering our capacity to deliver long-term impact and to retain talent and to train our staff to make sure that that thing that you really, really, really care about, where it is cats and dogs or international development or medical research, really happens. Because it doesn't happen on its own. You know, and I think that there's this misconception that if you work for a charity, you have to do it voluntarily or you have to work for free.
Yeah.
But no, as Jordi is saying, you know, like she had a degree and a special diploma and, you know, years and years of education and experience. And that costs money and that costs effort and it needs to be recognized. So maybe, you know, the question is more, how can we, you know, push the institute or raise our voices so this conversation and these efforts are brought to light and create more awareness around it to break these myths.
Yeah, I think that's probably the crux of it, to be honest.
Yeah.
And once that big issue is solved, the pay issue can quite naturally be solved afterwards. One day, obviously, once we're in charge, everyone will just snap our fingers and it's better.
Right? Yeah, the young people will take over.
But it is so difficult because, as I said, it was hard for me to get in, so I can't imagine what it's like for people that, you know, aren't going to university but want to become fundraisers and so should be able to become fundraisers and enter the sector easily, but the opportunity just isn't there, which is difficult because I don't know what the answer to that is.
Yeah, I mean, there's the whole non-grads welcome campaign on Twitter that's being run.
Yeah.
And actually, one of the things that's come out of that that's really interesting is the number of fundraisers that I really admire and respect openly saying that they don't have a degree.
Mm.
And it helped me realize my own internalized bias, because I was surprised by it.
Yeah.
Mm. And then I was surprised I was surprised. And I was like, I'm a bigot. I can see Tom making that clip his ringtone now. And that I think just continually challenging the requirements. I can't remember if it was the non-grads welcome campaign or something else, but someone showed me that your average community fundraising job posting has 21 essential requirements.
Wow.
That's just crazy.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
no one's good at 21 things.
No. Yeah. I'm barely good at 4, and I'm still here. So,
Yeah, I've noticed on LinkedIn, this great consultant, David Burgess, if you're out there, David, listening, basically going through different recruitment, fundraising recruitment agencies and commenting on their job ads and just saying,
amazing.
Why does this need a degree?
Nice.
And it just keeps coming up on my feed on LinkedIn and Twitter, and I'm just like,
that's
yeah,
awesome.
You go.
That's a little quiet revolution.
Yeah, exactly.
The streets of LinkedIn. I really love that. I find that more... As someone who started my career as a fundraiser, working for a very large children's charity and then a medium-sized charity, a small charity really, everyone around me had degrees, and it was only really it came to the forefront when I moved into the private sector, and it was anyone's game really. Lots of people just didn't have degrees, and I was shocked by it, as you said, and you're surprised by it, and then you're like, oh, it can't be surprised because.
Yeah.
That's most people. Most
yeah.
people don't do that.
Yeah.
Most people don't get that opportunity, or most people, it never even occurs to them to go to university. So you're definitely surrounded by that in the private sector, is what I found. And that's, again, that's a problem for accessing young people. Like, even getting rid of the degree-based requirements for a lot of fundraising jobs would instantly open it up to a way bigger pool of people. Way bigger pool of people. As long as there's some kind of equivalent and there's some kind of understanding of what that means, but it's just used as a stopgap. It's used as something to plug up the applications and being like, well, we're at least getting people that, you know, have managed to go to a library.
Yeah, but unless you've got a degree in fundraising, I don't really see the point. You
exactly.
know, I didn't talk about my degree at any job interviews, and I never will.
No, I have a philosophy degree, so that's never going to happen. No one cares. That's just a fact.
Cool. I think we probably can leave that there.
Yeah.
Knowing that there's a lot to be said around it and a lot to be said by young people.
Yeah.
So maybe the solution is ask.
Yes. Ask. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And one day we will work our ways to the top and remember that we had this conversation and not become those people
don't
ask.
I can see the trap. Jodie Marsden, CEO of Everywhere's intern, sending her this podcast recording, like, hey, I found this. And I just thought you should know.
I promise.
And also, I'm your intern and you're not paying me. So discuss.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wicked. Thank you guys so much for joining us. If people want to reach out to any of you to find more of you online, whether through Twitter or anywhere else, can you just give us either your Twitter handle or where people can reach you?
Or your LinkedIn.
Even if that's, please don't. starting with Emily.
Sure. So I'm on Twitter, even if I don't tweet that much. But you can find me at Anaili underscore C. Anaili is spelled Anaily
awesome.
Underscore C.
Nice. We'll
awesome.
Make sure we put links in the description as well so people can click things when they're on their phones.
Bradley?
You can find me on Twitter at Bradley French with an underscore at the end. There was already a Bradley French on there.
The young
Bradley
person
French.
Disadvantage. Damn! You got that first!
The underscore.
And finally, Jodie?
I obviously got in there quickly enough with my social media accounts because pretty much all of my social media is at Jodie Marsden.
Nice. Nailed it.
Nailed it.
Wicked. So if you want to speak more cats and dogs, find Jodie there. If you
all
want to
you homelessness.
Or specifically international development, go to Bradley, or general wonderfulness across the sector, Annalise, your woman. Thank you guys so much for coming on, and I hope to speak to you all soon.
Thank you, guys.
Goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you.